Welcome to the Art Scene, presented each week by UALR Public Radio. At the end of the year, Diane Rehm is retiring. The news has dealt a body blow to the millions of listeners who count on her to be the voice of rational thought, of quiet understanding of the many concerns, the issues brought to the discussion on her show each weekday morning. In her recently published memoir, On My Own, she tells of her husband's death in 2014 from Parkinson's disease, the years they had together from when first they met. A story exceptional in its honesty, in its clarity of purpose, and generosity in the exposure of the highs and lows of that marriage. She retires to join the fight to allow individuals the right to die as a matter of personal choice when all else fails. Recently, Diane and I talked of this, as described in her very moving book. What was her first thought the day On My Own was released?
Well, my first reaction was relief.
I thought it might be.
Because, you know, I did not know how it was going to be received. And I said to my editor, Bob Gottlieb, what if it's all bad? What if people hate the book? What if reviewers just say, oh, it's the worst book we've ever seen? He said, Diane, it is what it is. And that's all there is to it. And then when the reactions began to come out, honestly, I was overwhelmed.
Yeah.
And feeling such gratitude and such relief that people understood what I had tried to do.
So, in other words, it brought you comfort.
Oh, great comfort. And just so much gratitude that people not only, I mean, it was one of my dear friends, Roger Mudd, who had one of the first reactions to it. He called me and left a message on my machine saying, this is a gem. And coming from Roger Mudd, you cannot know how much that meant to me.
And was that after his wife had died?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Long after. And he is not well. He has serious back problems and has to have help throughout the day. But he is so clear in his thinking and in his ideas and his presentation that when he had narrowed his thinking down to one word, gem, I thought, wow.
Mm-hmm. Yes, because he was one of the people on, when he was working regularly, that one instinctively just listened to him because
he spoke
so well.
He was one of the finest anchors that CBS and NBC had.
Mm-hmm. Getting back to your book, it's unusual in that the format has no chapters. They're more like arrangements, short episodes, developing the story slowly. Was that your idea? Was that the way you wanted it to be?
It was the way I wrote it. It was the way it came to me. What can I say? I can just tell you that I wrote it episodically. I wrote it as, you know, for example, the episode regarding the bed and the pillow. I mean, it just came to me one night as I was about to get into bed and move the pillow. And I thought, I must write about this. Surely other people experience this. It's not just me, but it was just me at that moment. And I had to write about it.
Yes, and I think that you and I have commented on the fact that we were both, our wedding anniversaries are in December. Yours is the 19th, I think.
That's mine is exactly right.
And mine is the 21st.
Uh-huh.
And then you had a dear friend who died suddenly on Christmas Day in 2012.
Oh, my God.
My husband died on December 28th in 2012.
Oh, my goodness.
And the same thing. I got into bed the same side I always did. And he was the other side always. He sort of slept spoon fashion. And it took me a long time. It was more to do with the dog, I think. She wanted me the other side because of comfort. And she missed him and still misses him in a way that is very touching because she's a loving, lovely dog. But it was a heart that met the two of them.
Yes.
But getting, as I say, back to your breath, the short episodes, you start where you should, at the beginning, first met. And then it came to you, and I found with me, thinking of our first days together, took me out of the darkness of having lost him.
Well, you know, and that's what I find myself doing now. I think of him as a young, vital man, doing everything he always did, working around the house, working in the garden with strength. I mean, when we moved into our home on Worthington Drive in Bethesda, he took a pickaxe and broke up the driveway because I said I hated the look of that driveway in front of our home, and broke it up with such strength, and then created a hill where there had been a concavity where the driveway was, brought in tons and tons and tons of soil, and then planted the grass. And now that house has such a beautiful raised front garden. And, you know, that's how I think of him.
Yeah.
I think of him in that way, as young and strong and vital.
Now, the theme of this book is the fact that he died. And he died in such way that you had already begun to take over some of the anxieties of people who don't know what's going to happen to them when they die and they'd like to be able to command it. And then with the illness that he contracted, for which there's no cure, and you had to see this marvelously strong leader that you had as a husband, that it was in your mind, once you knew how ill he was and once he moved to assisted living, that you had to think of how you would put together something that would really matter to you and to him, as well as countless, countless people.
Well, it does seem to me that each of us, as we choose how to live our lives, have the absolute right to choose how we die. And by that, I mean that if one's belief in God is so strong that one would say, I wish to live until my God takes me, I totally support that. And if, on the other hand, another person says, I want to do everything I can to stay alive as long as I can with as much palliative care simply to keep me comfortable, that person should have that as well. But if, as John chose, one chooses to end one's life because, as John saw it, he had no further ability to carry out anything in the way of ordinary daily living. He could no longer feed himself. He could no longer bathe himself. He could no longer walk from bed to bathroom. He, too, should have the right to choose. And I see, as California has gone, as Oregon has gone, Montana, Vermont, Massachusetts, I do believe that the time is coming when states throughout the country will allow individuals to choose how they die. And I believe California may be the tipping point, but we shall see. John Rehm had to starve himself, had to deny himself water and medication, and it took 10 days for him to die. And I do not believe that those who choose to die should have to suffer in the way he did.
Did you talk the book over with him in those few days or the weeks, the months that he was depreciating and couldn't take command of his own life anymore?
I could not because I hadn't begun it.
Ah.
I began the book the very night John was dying. I was sleeping or trying to sleep on two chairs next to his bed with my little dog, Maxie, on my stomach. I could not sleep. So at 2 a.m., I got off the chairs and opened my iPad and began writing about what I was seeing and what I was feeling and how angry I was at what he was going through. And at 4 a.m. or 5 a.m., I've forgotten, two nurses came in to turn him. And he moaned as they turned him. And I said, "Why are you doing this to him?" Well, they said it was to protect him from bed sores. Well, you know, at that point. So at 7:30 that morning, his caregiver came. I went home to bathe and feed the dog, and his caregiver called and said, "Diane, please come quick. I think Mr. Rehm has just passed." So I got there 20 minutes too late. And as many nurses, caregivers, doctors will tell you, sometimes the loved one waits until you leave to die.
Mm-hmm. So you don't actually see it.
Exactly.
When you started the book, while you were writing it, you had some strange dreams.
Oh! You're the first person who's asked me about those dreams.
How many did you have? You just mentioned two, I think.
Oh, I had dream after dream after dream, but I wasn't going to write a book on dreams. But yeah, it was so, that first one was so frightening.
Mm-hmm.
So frightening to somehow be at our peaceful farm and meet up with hostile human beings who proceed to murder my husband, my daughter, and then my son. And then I find myself faced with this deep hole through which I would have to go or else be murdered by self. And at that point, thank goodness I woke up.
Mm-hmm. Not the sort of thing you would like to be woken up by.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Oh, it was terrifying. Probably one of the most terrifying dreams I've ever had in my life.
Did you have others of that type of terror during the course of rewriting it? Or was it a kaleidoscope of different colors and different stories?
Totally different. Never one that horrifying. I think I wrote about the other one, sort of seeing John in the bathroom, totally naked, beautiful, but nothing else.
Mm-hmm. Just one of the things you were never going to see again?
That's exactly right.
Yeah. Did you do any revising, or did you leave it as it came off your pen?
Well, I think there were a few edits that Bob Gottlieb and I talked about, and which seemed absolutely appropriate and reasonable. But if you ask me what they were, I do not remember. Mm-hmm. I think that he and I work so well together, work so closely. It's like a seamless conversation. Mm-hmm. You know, Bob Gottlieb ran The New Yorker. He was head of Canop for quite a while. I mean, he has such a profound and strong reputation in the literary field that, and when he makes suggestions, you know, I would send him 20 pages, and by darn, he'd call me back in like 20 minutes. That's how he worked.
Mm-hmm.
And he would say, well, now, do you really mean this? Or is this what you want to say? I mean, he would not, you know, go red penciling through my manuscript.
Mm-hmm.
He never did that. He's never done that with any of my books or the book that John and I wrote together. I mean, he is just this extraordinarily encouraging voice. And that's what he did with me on this book. We knew from the start it was going to be a small book. I wanted a small book. I wanted a compact book that a widow might choose mm-hmm. to pick up. A widower might see himself in my struggles. But, you know, the idea of John having to give up his control over his own checking account, how generous he was then to spend that following year helping me understand our finances, understand everything I needed to know, not just about the checking account, but about everything.
A remarkable man himself.
Oh, he was.
Yeah.
He was.
And you found that's what you needed. When he was talking and suggesting things, automatically you realized that this was the kind of advice and friendship you needed so badly.
Absolutely. And that's what I miss the most, that kind of advice and friendship. I mean, saying things to me like, oh, Diane, don't let that get you down. Mm-hmm. Or, oh, gosh, you know, words. Let's think more about the music, you know, and the sunsets. And I mean, writing that little piece on the sunsets, I just wrote from my heart.
While you were looking at a sunset?
While I was looking at a sunset.
Mm-hmm. When you went on this first tour, whose suggestion was the one you listened to most often?
When I went on this first tour, you mean after the book was released?
Of course, yes.
I think the suggestion I listened to the most came from my son and my daughter. They were both concerned for me that I would overdo it, that I would get too tired and get sick. I tend to get sick when I get overly tired. And they were both worried about me. And then I could hear John saying, Diane, go slowly. Mm-hmm. You really, really, really need to hold on to your strength. So I think that his voice is always going to be part of what I hear.
Mm-hmm.
I talk to him every single day.
Why not?
And he talks back to me.
Mm.
And that's wonderful.
Yes, and the ever-present enveloping awareness that you have with him is something that not many people have, but or if they do, they don't talk about it because sometimes it's too private. And this is where you are so generous with what you're telling the people who've lost and want to know how they can believe and how they can live with it.
Well, but that's why I was totally speaking from my own heart, rather than trying to tell people what they should do. I was speaking from my own experience, and everyone's experience is different. But I keep hoping that my own experience can somehow be of help to those who've also lost a loved one.
I think with the number of people that you've had calling you and speaking to you on your tour, you would get that reassurance.
Oh, my gosh. And, you know, the other thing they say to me is, please don't leave. Please don't stop doing your radio program. Please stay. And, you know, that's so lovely to hear. And yet, I know it's time. It's time after 37 years to hear other voices, to hear other ideas, younger ideas, fresher ideas. And yet, it's also important to go when people want you to stay, rather than to have people wondering, gosh, when is she going to leave?
I don't think that will ever happen. But also, you've got another charge.
Exactly. And I am going to do everything I can to speak out about the right to choose. I am calling it the right to choose rather than saying the right to die, because each of us deserves to have the choice that we personally want for ourselves.
And it's such a personal thing that politics has no place for it.
Absolutely correct. I fully agree with that.
Good time to stop.
Lovely.
And God bless, and all power to you, and may all your dreams be full of light and happiness.
Thank you so much. I've enjoyed talking with you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Unmistakably, that was Diane Rehm, known to millions through the radio program The Diane Rehm Show, aired live Monday through Friday mornings. Her memoir, On My Own, is published by Alfred A. Knopf, New York, 2016. Diane and I had talked for The Art Scene in 2010, prior to her visit to Little Rock on a fundraiser for UALR Public Radio. Listening to that interview again, I found this. I loved your description of your first on the air, when you were introduced to WAMU as a volunteer first.
Right.
And it seems almost as though your story is in step with NPR. So much of it you look at now, you wouldn't be able to do.
The other thing is that because NPR and all of its member stations were so young and so desperately in need of volunteers, it could be possible.
Yeah.
But at this point, my goodness, with NPR more than 30 years old, with this station now nearly 50 years old, I mean, the qualifications, the education, the background, the experience demanded, it certainly beyond my ability. People ask me, well, what gave you the courage to just go into that studio and start talking? Well, I think it was because I adored radio. I had been on the stage since I was 5. I hadn't really thought about doing this before I did it.
Yeah.
And just stepping in that way was the most marvelous introduction I could possibly have had.
Well, when you describe it almost as if you felt as though you were at home.
I did!
Yes, and I thought of you describing as you went to school how much you loved being on stage, the acting, and I thought that in many ways what you were doing was stepping onto a stage. You can imagine yourself as other than the young woman who doubted so much that she could do these things. You put on a mantle of disguise, as it were, and became who you are and have grown into that, so that you have that feeling of excitement every time the show comes up. And I wondered, when you go around the countryside, there's that same feeling of being on stage and an excitement of going out into the public and meeting people, like when you come down here.
That's such a perceptive comment, truly. I love what I do, and I do get excited. And when I'm on stage, I don't think of myself when I'm on the air, except when my voice is getting rough.
Diane Rehm, from an interview we had in 2010. Whatever she does, wherever she goes, she will make a difference. And that concludes this week's program. Please join us next weekend at the same time. I'm Ann Nicholson. Thank you for listening.
The Art Scene is a presentation of UALR Public Radio.